This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblet.
And our topic this week is...
iOS 16 Deployment Target.
Ooh, I was wondering when we were going to get to one of those.
Yes.
But first, we have some follow-up. And I'm going to open up the follow-up by saying that with this release of this episode, we are going to be entering our holiday hiatus. So starting December 17th, the day this is coming out, and ending on January 14th, 2024. So we'll see you in the new year for a little bit anyway, before I eat myself off to Japan. Next up in the follow-up is Sazura is back on the menu. So I've started a new project at work, and at least until July, I'm going to be using a Mac at work full time. So I've naturally installed Sazura on my work Mac, and some things have been annoying me. So I put out a new release. This was the first release since December 17th of 2021. So 2023.12.7 is out. It allows you to drag multiple tracks into a playlist at once. It also fixes a bug where the app would crash if you double-clicked on sort column headers too fast, because apparently there was a double-click handler that was crashing that I didn't account for. So very minor update, all things considered. And I've planned out a tiny little roadmap of just little quality of life fixes I want to do over the coming months. So for January, I think the goal is going to be to incorporate Sparkle so it can auto-update, because I'm tired of manually having to go and re-download builds all the time on all my machines. So I'll look forward to that in the near future. Development has resumed. Let's just say that.
Which is great. It seems that though it's only macOS development and not mobile or iOS development.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Oh.
But we can talk about that on a future episode. Anyway, you can go into your follow-up now.
Good. My first item is something we discussed in a bunch of episodes after episode 150, where we talked about Stadia. So as you may remember, Stadia is dead. So you might be stuck with a dead controller. But we brought up the fact that you could go on the Stadia website and do a firmware upgrade via Chrome, which was so weird, but hey, it works.
Through the magic of web USB.
Yeah, oh, I guess here, I forgot. No, it's web Bluetooth, isn't it? Or no, maybe USB.
You have to connect it via USB, yes, to patch it, so it's a Bluetooth controller.
Right. The issue with patching it for it to become a real Bluetooth controller is that support was supposed to end by the end of this month. And today, while just digging around on Threads, I realized that some people shared that Google has extended the deadline until next year. So the December 31st, 2023 deadline got moved to 2024. So we shall see if it's going to be a rolling deadline, but you have an extra year to upgrade your Stadia controller so it becomes somewhat useful again. But alas, if it's like mine, you've done it, you put it back in the box, and then it's in the box.
Or if it's like mine, you did it, you tried it out, and you had so many reliability issues while you were trying it out that you put it back in the box.
Moral of the story, it'll go back in the box. But yeah, at some point, we'll get this discarded, I guess, but we shall see. Next up, in episode 211, where I was talking about the recent social network news and the new social network, I've been talking a lot about I was eager or excited to see what Threads will be doing with the Fediverse. And guess what? They started to be included in, they started to federate. And it is unclear to me because they mentioned that the head of Instagram's account is federated. And everything I've read this week about that said, oh, my account and a few other accounts are now federated. I'm like, wait, what? That's how they turn on federation? But it seems like that's what they did. A few key people at Facebook or Instagram or Threads now have their Threads account federated to any ActivityPub compatible product, which for most people, means Mastodon. Related, or somewhat related to that, there's another big news on the thread. If you are a European citizen, you can now get access to Threads again, which I guess it means that I don't know if the news are fully related, but it's kind of funny that the same day they announced the start of the Federation, they did also announce Threads is back in Europe. But one of the key points I did mention in that episode and in certain follow-up, especially after we discussed that previously to our summer hiatus, was that they did the promise. We heard about those private meetings, but there was a lot of, especially on my side, there was a lot of, I'll believe them when we see it. And guess what? They stayed silent for the past few months, but now it's quote-unquote live. So I'm eager to see what will happen when more accounts gets federated. Yannick did tell me today that in the Fedi circles, this news is not really well received. Again, sparking a lot of the controversy of, oh yeah, Threads is coming to attack or invade the Mastodon activity pub and blah, blah, blah. So I guess I'm not eager to see that part because I'm kind of getting tired of that discourse, but I was gladly surprised that Threads started to deliver on their activity pub promise.
I think it's really funny that if you look at the authors of the ActivityPub spec, they are thrilled about this because it's kind of what they had in mind when they were writing the ActivityPub spec. But a lot of the users of the software that is built on top of the ActivityPub spec have a very different idea about what the Fediverse's values are in general. And I think that's one of the things where, since there is no single party steering what the values of the Fediverse is, it sort of creates this mismatch where everyone is constantly arguing about what the Fediverse is or should be, because there's no leader. It's just whatever happens to be the most popular software of the time wins and gets to define what the values of the Fediverse is. So that's a little awkward, but I did go and try it out on my Japanese Mastodon account because my instance has decided to completely defederate from threads.net from day one. And so far, I've had no compatibility issues with the thread stuff. Now, I don't actually care to follow anyone from the Instagram team, so I'm looking forward to the day that I can follow other people. But right, just poking around with it, it was working great. And at least the client developers I've seen outside of Japan, where Threads has gotten pretty good market share, or rather inside Japan, where Threads has gotten quite a bit of market share, they are excited to integrate with this, and they just are happy that they can actually bridge the connections between some of their friends that got stuck on Threads and some of their friends who would rather be using Miski or Mastodon. So at least my view of how the Fediverse should be is being explored a bit more in Japan than it is in the West.
Right, and it is something I've yet to try. I kind of forgot to do it this week, especially after seeing the news that it's only specific accounts. I was kind of a bit lazy. I didn't want to just search for the head of Instagram's federated account just for the sake of it. But I am eager to see what it entails because, again, a lot of people have dual accounts. Like, I have a Mastodon account. I also have an account on Threads because I'm on Instagram, so I'm eager to see what it will mean. There's a lot of people that, I guess, a bit like your Japanese friend, they kind of like deflected away from Twitter but never came to Mastodon. They stuck on Threads when it launched. So I do have a bit of people I follow there that's kind of like, oh yeah, it would be interesting that I just look at one app. So I'm eager to see that when it starts working fully for everybody. Good. Next up in my follow-up, in episode 217, when I talk about the panacea of modern ports, I thought things were pretty bad. Up until Cathode Ray Dude, one of our favorite YouTubers to Yannick and I, made a great post about his experience with Thunderbolt and certain Intel's motherboard I'll put a link in the show notes to his co-host page, but it is quite the journey. And if you can imagine that certain motherboard manufacturer Intel would retroactively remove Thunderbolt 1 and 2 support from boards that are also having Thunderbolt 3 supports, you are correct. Yeah, people do that, it seems. So I'm kind of glad that Apple is not doing that. And I don't want to say yet. Like we have old machines, they still support that. Like, I have a Thunderbolt display that I need a Thunderbolt 1, 2 to Thunderbolt 3 dongle, and it still works. But boy, after reading that post, I was like, seriously, there's manufacturers of that? And it seems there is. So Thunderbolt might be better, but not great for users on in the PC world, especially having to deal with strange decisions by board manufacturers.
I think what's even more cringe is Intel is a co-inventor of Thunderbolt. Like, I would understand if it was something like Lenovo or like MSI decides like, yeah, we're done with this Thunderbolt 1 and 2 shit. Nobody uses it on Windows anyway. But when it's Intel, the co-inventors of the spec who removes support for their own spec, that's completely galaxy brain to me. I don't understand the decision at all.
Agreed. I thought my episode was batshit crazy, but please go read this blog post because Cathode Redoute's opinion for sure is kind of on point, but the experiences he described in this post is just mind-boggling. So we'll have a link in the show notes, and of course, I'm sure we strongly suggest that you also go see his YouTube channel because it's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Last part, which is a combined Yannick and I having a shit ton of follow-up for the last episode game of the year. Would you mind if I start? Because I do have a strange follow-up.
Yeah, you've got a lot of shit to share, so you can start.
I wouldn't say I don't have a lot, but just that I think it is the first time ever that I have follow-up, 24 hours after
it was literally the day after.
Yeah, it was literally the day after. So I still kept my promise that I wouldn't buy a PS5. It's just that it somehow happened and got delivered to our own home. The gist of the situation is the next day I finish work late. We've been working from home. Tony go do some errands, and then he comes back, and then I go back in the in our living room, and there is a gift, and it's a big box, and I'm like, this box is weirdly shaped like a PS5 box, and it weighs a lot, and yeah, and Tony was super excited to kind of say, oh, you have to open it now. I'm like, okay, so TLDR, yes, I did receive a PS5 as a Christmas gift or a holiday gift. And the funny story too is I did play a few games, but more or less since we received it, Tony has been playing a lot of PS5 too. So it's a gift for both of us, but he's been enjoying it greatly. And dare I say, more than I do. But related to that, it meant that I did have to reinstall some of my PS4 games, which meant I rolled the credits on 13 Sentinel.
Yeah.
That. So I think I was maybe 3 or 4 hours. No, not even. It's just because I was trying to have a status in all of the and some of the battle missions. But more than that, I won't say much more. But yes, I saw the credit roll. So again, if you didn't listen to the previous episode, it is one of Yannick's top 4. I won't say which number it is, but it is a great recommendation, even coming from me. And I think that covers my own follow-up for Game of the Year episode. What about yours?
So as I mentioned on the episode, I had forgotten to put the listener messages about their Games of the Year into my notes. So I noted them for this episode, and
that's
we'll
good.
Go through them now. So first off, with listener Greg, here's their toot. all I played in 2023 were old, obscure, and or garbage multiplayer games with friends, so my pick would be Planet Mule. And I tried to look up this game, and shockingly, it is a game that has zero videos on YouTube, which is wild. Huh. I have rarely run into that. Like, I do videos on obscure Wonderswan shit, and they almost always have a video, even if it's, like, automated by bots that make videos of every video game ROM they download. So Planet Mule is actually a remake of Mule for the 8-bit Atari computers, which was one of EA's first games back in 1983, and apparently it was a must-have game for the platform. I've never heard of it, but apparently Atari 400 and 800 fans love it. And it seems very similar to board games with exploration and economic development. I saw that, like, they were inspired by Monopoly, but it looks kind of like a cross between Monopoly and Risk, which is really odd to me. I don't know. I might have to look at this game. It sounds very strange. And then a friend of the show, Kit, wrote in to say that they mostly played Train Sim World 4, which is totally on brand, which has a good variety of routes and puts more emphasis on reading train gauges instead of game UI, which is definitely something rail fans appreciate, of course. And they also recommend the Talos Principle 2, which is a recent release, actually. It's one of the first Unreal Engine 5 games to come out that is really major. It's a first-person puzzle game, kind of like Portal, question mark. I don't know a ton about it. But apparently there's lots of liberty in how you solve and come up with solutions. There's none of the jank that you typically find in physics-based puzzlers. And judging by their comments, it seems like it really sneaks into your brain. They mentioned having thought of solutions just as they were falling asleep. And, like, the impression I get is, like, it gets in your head and you can't stop thinking about it, which is generally a pretty good thing for those kinds of games. I'm probably too stupid to play this game. But I've seen the trailers for it, and the aesthetic was very striking to me, so I might have to go check it out. And I believe it is on Game Pass, so I might not have to try very hard to try it. Those are the notes that we had from our listeners. I thought I had one more, but either it was deleted or I imagined it. So that sucked, but whatever. Thanks to our listeners for writing in. We always love to hear what you are up to. And Game of the Year is always a fun time where people can write in and share what they've been playing over the years. And I'm looking forward, like, it's pretty much that time of year where all the Game of the Year videos are going to come out on YouTube. So I'm very excited for my week off next week.
Nice. Yeah, me too. I'll sure put it in my YouTube queue and then watch them during the hiatus.
Yeah, that's it for me.
Thank you, Yannick. Then we'll go into the main topic. So for our last episode of 2023, we will be running our traditional iOS minimum deployment target. So we're back onto an iOS development topic for this week. This is a tradition because we'll be running this 7th annual episode about that. And if you're new to the podcast or you skip and decided to listen to this episode but not the previous years, the goal of this episode is to revisit new APIs introduced in the previous iOS version. And the reason why we're not talking about the current iOS version is because this comes from the general consensus that as an iOS app developer, you should support having a support strategy that contains the current and the previous version. Meaning that hopefully this year, you will be saying that your app only supports devices running iOS 16 and 17. If you're unlucky and you're working on an N-2 strategy, meaning that you're at iOS 15, I strongly suggest that you revisit our previous episode. For iOS 15, you can listen to episode 193. And hopefully you're not in that situation, but if you're stuck on an N-3 strategy, you can go back to episode 173 for iOS 14. So hopefully that's not the case, but I know some of you that are stuck on a strategy where you want to have broader device support. And I know that those OSs might bring things that you forgot, because again, those might have been announced like a few years ago. So this episode will be separated into two main categories, where we'll be talking about UI frameworks, because yes, now we have to talk about more than one, and just general Swift framework updates that didn't come directly from Xcode itself or running the latest Swift versions of the language, but more by that are dependent on OS changes. That meant that if your app was not running on iOS 16, you couldn't use those features. And I think those new frameworks were central enough to an app integration or an app's architecture or way of implementing solution that it made little sense to just start using it in the middle of your deployment target being updated. Now that you have a base where you know it's this, these frameworks will be always present, it makes more sense to rely on those new frameworks compared to say, oh, I have a custom solution for this problem on iOS 15 and on iOS 16 and up, I'm using Apple provided framework. So first, we will be talking about our beloved UIKit. And I'm sure we'll be going into that and I spend the next 30 minutes. But after reading to the API diffs, after watching a few dubbed videos from 2022, kind of realized that it was a slow year for UIKit. The main changes were regarding what I would call the desktop class app for iPads. So there was new navigation bar style, the browser and editor. So if you've been using an iPad in the past 2 years or the past 18 months, I should say, you realize that, let's say, if you look at the files app, it has more controls available in the navigation bar that fits the fact that it's more a browser-based application and not a navigation stack application where you navigate from one view down in another view down in the view hierarchy. On top of that, UI navigation bar has more customization points to put more action in it, kind of reminiscent of the old NS toolbar on macOS that, yes, has been tweaked in the recent macOS version, but now you can create UI bar button item groups and group action in it. And if you have also too much action, the OS will create an overflow menu for you, bringing the customized toolbars functionality that is used for decades on macOS also to iPadOS application. With the browser and editor navigation bar style, there is a new title view. So the title of a view is no longer centered in the navigation bar. It is leading wing. So it's aligned on the leading side of the navigation bar. And when you tap on it, you now have access to a new menu that you can customize. Certain actions in that menu are enabled by default. So if you provide the print functionality, if you provide the move functionality, a copy functionality, again, that depends on the type of navigation bar style you want to be. So if you're a browser, you might not want to propose a print action, but for sure, if you're an editor, like a page document, print might make more sense. So this menu can be customized and has automatic behavior, like defining a print action when you implement the print content delegate in your views. On top of providing new navigation bar elements, there is a new find and replace experience, which is nice and ironic at the same time, because if you've developed any form of iOS application in the past decade, you kind of know that UI search controller is not great, and then implementing a search functionality, you always more or less end up having to build something custom in your own UI and not rely on Apple provided tools. So I haven't personally used those new experiences they can provide, but again, they do fit, especially on iPad, with the new navigation bar style, because for example, you can have the find search bar in place in the navigation bar and have a suggestion that you put them there yourself. So when you start typing, there's a menu that automatically appears below the text field for the search bar, and those have the typical iOS look of the menu components. Speaking of menus, when you are able to, when you trigger the edit menu. So let's say you are in a text field and you press and hold to get the copy action and things like that. Those are now based on UI edit menu interaction, which replaced the old UI menu controller, and its look and feel changes based on which devices triggers the interaction. So for example, on iOS or on the phone, it would look like the typical popover with a few buttons that you can swipe to go through the list. On the iPad or on Mac OS, it will more or less look like a menu. And for sure, if you use a cursor, it will really look like a right click or a secondary action, like you used to do, you used to on desktop applications. So that concludes the desktop class components and updates for UIKit. The second section of updates for UIKit is new controls. There's not that much, but there are two main ones. The first one is called UI Calendar View, and it is a new component that you can use to allow selection of dates. As its name suggests, Calendar View means it's a view of the calendar that can be somewhat customized to your need and for sure have customized selection behavior. So you can have multi-date selection, or you can select a whole week, or you can select dates sporadically throughout the calendar. It's up to you to configure this component. And again, depending of the type of date selection you want, you'll get the appropriate delegate calling back to you. At the same time, even if the look and feel is baked by the framework, there are the possibility to add decoration to dates. So the important thing to note about those decoration is, yes, you can do anything you want with them, but A, they don't have any interaction possibilities, and B, Apple controls the space available to them, and if it's too big, they'll get clipped. So you have to work with the constraint that UI Calendar View provides when you want to add decorations. A few of the examples they've shown is put an emoji on top of a date, or just a small, like, I think the team was like, they were using red as their key color, so a red dot above certain date, maybe to indicate that you already have an appointment or you have already something configured in your application that makes sense for your business logic. So it's far up to you to define, but yes, you can decorate views in this calendar view. This, again, a lot of those things was a fun reminder to me, because again, I didn't have the opportunity to use them. It's not like, especially calendar view, it's not something that I need daily in the types of apps I built, but I do know that we were using some of the previous components that were available, and that I could see also a lot of third-party code being removed by using one that is provided by Apple and not having to build your own calendar view if the one that was previously available was not fitting your needs. So again, another good opportunity to see if what's provided by the framework fits your need in such a way that you remove code, and less code mean, in theory, less bugs. Next new component is, in the past few OSs, Apple has been putting more privacy prompts. And one of them that was added in the recent OSs, I think it was in iOS 15, and in iOS 16 got quote-unquote promoted to being an alert, is access to UI pasteboard, so the pasteboard copy and paste. But they kind of realize that, A, if it's presented as an alert versus just a small banner that says, hey, this app tries to access your pasteboard, it can be quite annoying. And in the same vein as a previous friend we discussed in those episodes, CL location button, which is a button that gives the application your geographical location, you also have now UI paste control, which will allow you to, on the top of a button, copy or paste directly at the direct access to the pasteboard. And the idea behind this component that Apple provides is, you as a developer don't need to directly access the pasteboard, because you might be doing it at the moment that it is not based on your own user's input. Now with UI space control, you can provide your own custom control for accessing the pasteboard or like pasting something in your app, and also indicating that this access was okay for the user, meaning that the user is putting their intention behind, yes, I want this application to have access to the pasteboard. So, of course, when you use UI paste control as a button, you don't need to, you will circumvent some of the privacy alerts you would get if you were directly accessing the pasteboard. Good. Last update on controls or new controls. This one is more of an update. It's the UI page control, aka you want to have multiple pages where you can just swipe in between. There are more customization points for this old school UI kit control. You can now customize the indicator and the selected indicator, and you can also customize the layout direction, which to me it was a surprise because I think UI page control is like iOS 4 or something that old, and the fact that you couldn't customize it that much was one of the main reasons why in previous apps I've seen a lot of custom page control because people wanted to customize it the way they want and Apple was not providing. Will this be, again, a reason to switch? I think it's pretty minimal. I think for a lot of people, the fact that the dot indicator can now be customized might be, but again, not that much of a big update. A few important things regarding Swift concurrency and UIKit. So async await or Swift concurrency is something I've been discussing a lot in our previous episode about Swift and iOS development. And one of the important thing is it tries to remove as much as it can at compile time data erase conditions or data erase issues. And now they've mentioned that UIKit has marked a few types, UI image, UI color, UI font, and UI trait collection as what they call sendable, meaning that it cross actor boundary. The best example they can provide is they say, oh yeah, you get an image, you want it to put it into your image processing pipeline. So you can take the same UI image instance from the main actor to your image processing actor and then send it because they know that these data types are immutable. So crossing actor boundaries is considered safe. So the idea is if you've built box sendable structure to allow you to do that currently because the UIKit framework was not properly audited for sendability, now Apple has done that for you. Okay, last up for UIKit, it wouldn't be a UIKit episode or a UIKit section, I should say, if I didn't talk about UI collection and UI table view. Of course. The big update for this year is for past few years, UI collection and table view cells are self-sizing. They've launched self-resizing, meaning that if the size of a cell changes in its lifetime, it will adapt. And now is in iOS 16, that's enabled by default. So you have to be aware of this. And also you might need to do certain configuration on your cells and on the view itself to indicate which type of resizing behavior you want. So if you've been using the UI list content configuration that was announced in the past few OSs, that does automatic like size validations, meaning that if the cell needs to grow, it will grow. If you need to manually invalidate the size of a cell, you can call invalidate intrinsic content size. I'm sure if you've ever coded a UI collection and table view in your life, you've been aware of intrinsic content size for that. One thing to note too that is important is if you want to perform the resizing without animation, it's important to call invalidate or any of your changes inside of a perform without animation from UI view block. And on top of that, if you're somebody that uses auto layout, you can set the self-sizing invalidation property of UI collection and table view to enable including constraints. So yes, you can again have auto layout working in your cells content view and also force a resizing. And guess what? It should work. I haven't done too much UI collection view and table view code in the past 6 months. I'm mainly doing Swift UI these days. But even revisiting this and like reading about those changes, I was like, oh boy, I wish we had that literally 3 years ago, because you cannot imagine a lot of the custom code I had to do for trying to make it work correctly, especially self-sizing cells, self-resizing. That was always a few bugs that would rub you off. And last up, regarding self-configuration, and we'll come back a little bit in the Swift UI section, but iOS 16 brings another extension point where if you're mainly a UI kit application, but you want to start dabbling in Swift UI, we still have UI hosting controller, but now in iOS 16, you can have a UI hosting configuration. And remember, this goes with the iOS 15 content configuration API, where you provide a configuration object to a cell and the cell knows how to render itself. But now with a UI hosting configuration, the configuration specify a Swift UI view. So you can then, for the content of your cell, whether it's on collection or table view, you can provide the cell's content view as a Swift UI view. Speaking of Swift UI, we're done with UIKit. So we'll be talking about the other UIKit framework. And this one this year, again, has more updates because it has a lot to catch up on UIKit. And at the same time, with a lot of the feedback that developers brings back to Apple, I think we've seen some changes to it meant that it is easier to use in the application. And the first one I want to talk about is navigation stack and navigation split view. So since the first release of Swift UI in iOS 13, the way you would describe navigation, or that you want a view that can allow navigation, is you would just do a navigation view, which combine both the stack and the split view components into one view. And it was your job as a developer to use the navigation style and modify it. This was causing a few issues, and it was a tree-based API, meaning that in the navigation view, you would have to render all the leaves. So if you say this is a navigation link, a destination I can go to, what the navigation link would points to is another view. So then you have a view that points to another view that points to another view. So you would end up describing the whole tree of that navigation in your root, quote unquote, a navigation view, which could become a bit cumbersome to manage. That's why they now introduce navigation stack. You can still use this tree-based API, but now they allow you to have data-based navigation, meaning that the navigation is based on your own data type, and that when you push a certain data type on the stack, the API, you can define the destination for those data types with your own structs, for example. Also, an example that I've seen mentioned a lot in the Apple documentation is it also allows for different types of navigation. And the best example they've given you is, I think it was an app where you can navigate fruits definition. And then let's say you have a list of like apple, oranges, bananas, and you click on oranges. So you have a nice detailed view describing what a banana with images. And there's a section just below that says, oh, other fruits you may like, which will point to a similar fruits detail view. And those kind of, I would call recursive navigation, was way harder to do in the three-based approach than the stack-based approach, because now you can say, oh, I'm just pushing yet another fruit data type on the stack, and then by using the new navigation destination, you get the fruit data, and then you can create a, you can create your own Swift UI view for this. And the navigation stack takes care of the push and pop animation for you. Also, by being data-based, you can just have access to the array of the state of this stack, and you can do array-based operation in it. If you want to pop three views, you can just remove all the elements up until a certain index in the array, and then SwiftUI will take care of doing the pop-pop-pop animation for all those screens. And the same data model applies to navigation split view, but it is now easier for you to, it's putting yourself in control of when you want a navigation stack versus when you want a navigation split view, because with the navigation view, while you can specify the navigation style, the OS might decide that, oh, because you're in this or on this phone in this orientation, they might override your navigation style because they decided that like a split view made more sense here versus a stack. Now, by having those two controls, you decide which one you have, because, hey, if you ask for a split view, you got a split view. If you ask for a navigation stack, you're stuck with the navigation stack. And for sure, by doing it this way too now, you can have navigation stack inside the navigation split view, and it is explicit, whereas before it was a bit implicit. Next up, we also have access to two new, what Apple likes to call, scene-based controls. More or less their equivalent, say, scenes is windows. So in Swift UI, especially if you're a full Swift UI application, you would have seen that on the Mac with your application main by locate. It would instantiate a window group in your root view. But now there's a new window. And this is to just open a single window with a single view in it. And Apple describes this as being pretty great for auxiliary windows in your application, something that can just be open and dismissed. And they're not really a complex hierarchy of views inside. For that, you would still use window group and multiple windows as a component. On top of that, SwiftUI has now the menu bar support, meaning that you can define your menu bar extras, and the control is literally called menu bar extras, as SwiftUI views, which also means that you don't have to rely on your AppKit to do that. And also, like on AppKit, you could have menu bar extra applications that are just a menu bar icon and views there. You can also do that with the SwiftUI equivalent. Okay, now we enter the section where we talk about the updates to existing controls. So you can build form-based views for a while with Swift UI, but if you want the lovely, and I put it in really square quotes, look and feel of form as shown in macOS system settings, you can use the view modifier named form style group. This form style will adapt to this new look and feel. And it is also based per platform. So iPadOS and iOS will do different adaptation of the form style grouped to make more sense for this.
People are lining up to adopt it.
Yes, for sure. I can imagine that they're lining up. Related to that too, I won't go through all of them because there's a bunch. But depending of all the other controls you put it, they've done a bunch of small tweaks to make sure that these controls, like a text field, the expanding behavior of a text field, having a formatter for steppers, also having toggle buttons look differently, and having the F selected state, especially if you have like four options and things like that. They've tweaked a lot of the existing controls to make them work better when you put them inside of a form view. So I would invite you, I have a few links about that in the show notes or about Swift UI changes where you can find the finer grain details about which control change how when they're put in a form view. And like we discussed in the UI kit section, there is an equivalent to UI calendar view that is named multi-date picker that gives more or less the same experience, but in a Swift UI fashion. So you can have access to this new components in a Swift UI view. One component that is new in Swift UI for iOS 16 is something we discussed in previous episode because Yannick was so hyped about it until he started to read the documentation. And it is the table
control.
Which means that now on iPadOS, and I think on iOS 17 or on the later OSs, it did some changes and fixed some of the downsides. But sadly, if you're in the iOS 16 minimum deployment target, when it runs in compact size class or on iOS, it's a bit dumb as a control. But on iPadOS, you have access to real tables with headers, with sort descriptors, with multiple columns. So you can show more dense information in the table and not just being a list view. Even if we remember, like, the UI table view is not really a table, it's more of a list. And on top of that, on top of your table column definitions, you can also have context menus to the rows. So for sure that works great for when you use a pointer on the iPad, and also works great when you do that for macOS application. But yes, big downside is table doesn't really exist on mobile phone, aka on iOS, or when you resize your iPad app. Next up, navigation bar. I won't go through too much details because, again, a bit like the multi-date picker and the UI calendar view, a lot of the changes to navigation bar are also available in SwiftUI. Same thing with the find and replace UX. So if you're using the searchable view modifier, this is all available. One component that I didn't mention in UIKit, because it has been existing in UIKit for a while, but there was not exact equivalent to it in SwiftUI, is the photo picker. So now there's a native photo picker component that more or less allows you to select photo from your photo library, but you deal with, like, Apple deals with all the UX for you. You don't have to code anything. It just give it to you. And if I recall correctly, I forgot to note it down, so that's why I'm not 100% sure, but my recollection of the UIKit version, and I would assume the same thing for the SwiftUI version, is for that component, you don't need to deal with the privacy concerns that is having access to the photo library, because this one, after the selection, will only return you the asset that has been chosen by the user and nothing more, nothing less. Last but not least is something I forgot. Unlike table, which made a lot of noise when it was announced, I forgot about grid. And I wish the app I was working on was iOS 16 and up. And B, I wish I remembered about it literally, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago, because it would have helped me simplify a bunch of UI elements. But grid is more or less when you end up with a bunch of HStack and VStack, grid is there to help you. It is more or less, like its name suggests, a component or control that allows you to put elements or views in a grid. Sounds simple, but again, before that, you had to do it yourself by combining horizontal stacks and vertical stacks, whereas now you have the grid component and the grid row and a bunch of view modifier to say, okay, this row, this element in the row will take 2 columns out of 4 columns I've defined in my grid, and things like that. So to make designs where your design puts things in a grid and it's all well aligned, and then you are frustrated when that doesn't work because you have to do it yourself manually, now there's something to save yourself. Good. So that concludes our UI framework section. And if I stop for a bit to just make a meta comment about UI frameworks, it is starting to be, it's nice to see that UIKit still has updates. But again, like my own time devoted to UIKit views in the past year, it shows why the updates are more minimal to it than with SwiftUI, because I think SwiftUI is kind of doing, playing the catch-up game, but doing it at a great pace without having to... I think we're slowly, but you'll have to revisit, and again, that's preparation for next year, but I'll have to revisit in the next few weeks what were the new things for SwiftUI, because I get the feeling that we're now, I don't say we're past where they're equivalent, but we're slowly getting into the, we don't need to have everything we used to have in UIKit, but to make you swallow this pill, we'll give you nice tools that are not available in UIKit, but they're only available in SwiftUI for you to start using SwiftUI. So we're kind of in this zone with 16, and I think too, from my recollection of this summer with iOS 17, that is, we're maybe like at 75-80% there with the compatibility list between those two UI framework, but SwiftUI is pushing in different direction that wouldn't have access to that. You would have to work in its declarative manner to get those benefits. And one of those benefits we'll see in a future section about some charts. But before we talk about charts, to start this section about Swift frameworks generally, there are three frameworks I want to talk about. And the first one is regex. I don't have to, like, on the type of apps I use, I don't have to do string processing too much, but you know, sometimes you have to use with regex, and I don't want to say that I don't know regex, but I think it regex is in the category of, I'll call it a language, where I use it frequently enough to know things, but not frequently enough for it to be intuitive.
Yeah.
So I always have to rely on third-party documentation or like web pages where you just, like, it's more or less of a builder. You play with it. You put your text. You want it to ensure its format and things like that. So one thing that I really like about the fact that now Swift will have a regex library as a first class citizen is that they also are bringing compiler checks for it. So first, regex are now a struct in the framework. They are also they also have literal support. So if you start now something with slash and you start typing and then close it with another slash, the compiler will A, try to do syntax highlighting, assuming that this is a quote-unquote string defining a regex, and also try to compile it, ensuring that it is a valid regex. On top of that, if you have a lot of capture groups, which that gets, especially when you have capture groups in the syntax of a string regex, it can be a bit more complex. They now have an extended literal too, that is the pound sign and then slash, and then the slash and the pound sign to close that string, that allows you to have non-semantic white spaces to align things to make it a bit more readable. And last but not least, because it is Apple and they're pretty into declarative style of frameworks, they also have a regex builder that is built on top of the builder declarative pattern, which is, okay, I want to have a capture, and then you define what you want to capture, or you say, I want to do a one or many of an ASCII character, and then build a builder the same way you're in SwiftUI, you're defining a variable that is a sum view. So you can do that and have something that, because again, because those are components that you build together and they're not using a language, they're using English because they're structured that are matched together, it is a bit more clear. Because they have proper names. So you don't need to remember the capture group syntax because it's called capture. And then you define in it what you want to capture. On top of that, in those builders, you can use the system parser. So let's say here you're trying to parse in the string a date. So you can do go capture me a date and then define its format. And then the data returned by the regex is no longer going to be a string, or should I say a substring, because of course string language in Swift for that, they'll return you a substring, but they will return you a date object, or even better than that, if you defined an enum, because what you're trying to parse is a certain string that means that I think the best example I've seen when they were I was reading example is they were trying to parse the error logs, and they would say, okay, this is passed, this failed, and they define an enum. So when the regex executes, you don't end up with a substring, you end up with the enum value that is better, that is easier to access in your language. In the end, I think the big benefit of regex builder to me is, and to the regex as a first class editor, is it's trying to make it easier, simpler to understand regex and make it easier to use in a Swift code base. And this is, again, something I really want to try. Again, I haven't had the opportunity to write regex recently. I haven't had the opportunity to try it recently because I don't have that much regex. And again, this is something that sadly, even if it was baked in the Swift language, the OS you needed deployed need to have a minimum deployment target. And sadly for iOS, it was iOS 16. Next up, and I teased it a bit just before in the Swift UI section, is Swift Chart. Another declarative framework, but this is again a declarative UI, like Swift UI, to build, you guessed it, charts. What I like about that, again, it's different type of charts, and all of them are conforming to Swift UI view, so they can be put anywhere in your view hierarchy, like any view in Swift UI. What I really liked about it is twofold. First, the customization possibilities reminds me of literally building a chart in iWork or Numbers or any of the iWork products. B, because you don't describe, you describe the data, the axes, what they call the marks, so you want lines, bars, points, and all of them can be combined. Because you're describing the data and not what you want, you get a lot for free. For example, it supports dynamic type for you. It supports dark mode for you. It has accessibility in mind. One thing I remember discussing in previous WWDC episode is the audio graph, where you can use audio cue to describe the trend of a graph. Guess what? They do it for you. So I'll go quick through, like I'm going quick into this one because again, it's charts. And the way to see it is I will have to show code examples. And in a podcast, you can imagine it's a bit hard. But this, I am, again, it's a common theme for this week that there's a lot. Compared to previous episodes of iOS Deployment Target, this episode, preparing for the episode, was a good reminder. And I was like, oh, I remember it was Swift Charts. And I forgot to do example projects just to play with it. I think I've did like when it announced maybe a playground. So last summer, well, the summer 22 when it got announced, but this is something I need to put back on my quote unquote to-do list to go try because it seemed so simple to use yet so powerful that I kind of want to battle test it just for, and again, I don't have no reason at work to battle test it, but I really want to play with it because it seems really nice. And yet again, another great example where you don't need to now put third-party code to do something as complex as charts with animations in your code base. Apple provides you something for you. Last up is transferable. So transferable is a Swift first, yet again, declarative way to describe how you serialize and deserialize data for sharing purposes, whether it is for the share extension, the share sheet, copy and paste, or drag and drop. So transferable is a way to describe your model so it can be exchanged with different part of the OS or two different application. So it's kind of a reimagining of what you would do with NS user activity or through the access to UI space board. Yes, they're still based on UTIs. There's still things you need to define in your info.plist, but the rest is code again. So the only things you have to define is that app can expose this data, but you don't have to deal with too much more plist information to define how you get drag and drop targets and copy paste and also the data type you want to accept for sharing purposes. The other nice benefit for that, which was available before but it was cumbersome to do, especially let's say for example when you want to expose your own data to the pasteboard, is that it's now easy because again there's a way using declarative syntax to do so. You can represent your model into different what they call transfer representation, and the best example I can give you is let's say you want to share your dream car list. So that's the goal of my app for today. And you've inputted, I don't know, like some Ferrari, I forgot which one. But you've inputted that in your list. And you could define that you would want to share a photo you've taken of that Ferrari. And also, if you want to do copy-paste, like maybe the photo is not the right thing, or the photo is the right thing, but you also want to define a string for app, like you want to copy, quickly copy the name, so you don't have to go in your application, select the name column in your list, just by doing Command-C by selecting the row, and then Command-V in a text field, you would be able to just expose the name of that car. So in your application, that is your car dream list application, you could then, for your row defining this dream car, define two representations, an image representation and a text representation, and the OS will know what to do with those representations based on where you're transferring it. The idea with the transferable is you're describing how you go from your model to binary to your model, or in some of things, like for example, your model to a string. Again, you cannot recreate your own model with just a string, so there are one-way operations. And this is not something I've used, but I've used the previous versions of that for drag and drop in some small photo projects, photo apps I've built in the past few years. And it is something, literally, I was re-watching the stuff and I'm like, I need to go update the project I have explore the EXIF data from the API for EXIF data from macOS. And I'm like, I remember playing with drag and drop, and I'm pretty sure that it was not using the transferable protocol. So I'm pretty eager to see what I can do with this in my fun photo toy app, because it seems way simpler than what I remember having to do for this. Okay. This more or less wraps up what I wanted to discuss for iOS 16. I do have, again, like a meta comment. I did have the same section for UI, for the UI frameworks, but I feel that looking through this, it was getting harder. We talked a lot about Swift-based APIs, and one thing that I've used throughout the years to help me quickly glance when SDKs are ready to release is API diffs. And the API diffs right now on the dev portal are pretty, like, compare Xcode 15.1 to Xcode 15.0. I'm like, that's not what I want to know. I really want to know, like, maybe, like, iOS 17 versus 15, 16 and 16 to 15, just so it's easier for me to get the general guidelines. Again, on Objective-C frameworks, there were tools for people to do so, and people have built such pages on the web to see at a glance what are the differences in header files. And I'll for sure include the one that I usually look at that has a page for from 15.5 to iOS 16 flush. And if you go look at their previous episode, you'll see I always find this page. And this one is really useful because usually when I will go and will go, when I want to be reminded of something quick, I was like, I remember there's something new in core data on this OS, on this SDK version. Usually going this page, clicking the core data framework, I'm like, oh yeah, that's the name I was looking for. Don't have to Google for it, just going to that website. But what I see is while the docs are improving on developer.apple.com, that is still hard to figure out. You more or less have to go through either WWDC videos or some of the dub content. Or I think what's better a bit is people have written like, hey, what's new in iOS 16 SDK, and find the developers that are rebuilding that. But I do miss, and I do see the limited value of the quote-unquote, not automatic, but the processing tools we used to have when you have header files to see what are the differences between SDK X versus version Y. So hopefully this won't make my life a bit too hard in the coming years. But to get a glance of the general idea of the changes, I feel this is getting harder and harder, unless you literally have to go read Swift codes, Swift files from Xcode itself.
Yeah, I feel like the way in which you could use class dump on Objective-C also really opens those doors up in a way that Swift frameworks don't really have, that because they're encoded in a completely different way that's harder to reverse engineer in that way. And it sucks, honestly, but
yeah, that's that. And again, there are a good example I've seen in the docs is it was saying like, oh, what's new in Swift? And then you look, it's like June 2023. I'm like, yeah, but what about June 2022? And that you have to more or less figure out yourself by going through the documentation and see what's marked as available starting iOS 16, which that mm-hmm. sucked. The diff for this year, though, like it's nice. Like it's not really a diff, but it's more like of a change log. And it was like, oh yeah, here's what we introduced in SwiftUI in June 2023. I was like, okay, yeah, that's cool. But I guess the moral of the story is I need to maybe snapshot, save this web page to make my life easier like next December, because I wouldn't be surprised that next summer when the next version of SwiftUI or any of those Swift framework that I discuss, if they introduce those what's new in those pages, like they'll be focused on the recent changes and not a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that concludes my iOS 16 deployment target. I'll have a few links in the show notes about some of the documentations. Again, the Objective-C API diffs, that for sure. So if you want to quickly find it or you forgot where it is, I'll have a link for it in the show note. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, speaking of the show notes, you can find all of them at limitlesspossibility.net. More specifically, you can find this episode, if it's not the latest at the time, at limitlesspossibility.net/219. The show is on the Fediverse at limipo_podcast@mastodon.social. We are also individually on the Fediverse. I am at Sakarina at icosahedron.website, and Luca Olivier is at
luco@mastodon.social.
And we'll see you next year.
See you next year.